Yeah. Hey, it's Kevin Pollak, your host for episode 21 of my Mrs. Maisel pod. Welcome back. How have you been? According to your emails, you're doing A-OK. And it's good to know that. Please continue to write to us, of course, my Mrs. Maisel pod at Gmail. Love reading all you have to say, your comments, your questions, your insights, your reminders, your casting ideas for who to have on the show. All of this is appreciated, as well as your continuing efforts to get the word out. Tell everyone you've ever met, sort of thing. Yeah, it's a beaten drum and a replaying recording of me saying that. But, you know, it really does make a difference to rate, review, and subscribe. So today, we are going to take a look at the episode 1 of season 3. And it's, as it turns out, my guess, Katrina Lenk, we had ourselves a time, such a delightful time, that it's going to have to be broken into 2 episodes. So this will be part 1 of my Mrs. Maisel pod, episode 21, with Katrina Lenk. Tony Award-winning Katrina Lenk. Yeah. She's exceptional and plays the most interesting character on the show, which we'll talk about. She, of course, won her Tony for a band's visit with our own Tony Shalhoub, who also won a Tony Award for that. In fact, I remember he won while we were shooting, I think, in the Catskills, or I remember some sort of, yeah, it had happened just before we went to the Catskills during the shooting of season 2. Anyways, very exciting, very amazing. And this was an exceptional guest that I really enjoyed talking to. I tried to get as many women on the show as possible as guests, not just for obvious reasons, which is this is a female-centric series, story, creation, created by. But also, I, as a host of a conversation, will always find women to be ultimately 91% more interesting than men. Almost every, it's almost without exception. Now, is that, you know, you can draw your own conclusions. And also, the 9% of men that are clearly more interesting, not by much. It's just by a little. Yeah. So the truth of the matter is, it's out of respect to this almost entirely women-centric effort that is the marvelous Mrs. Maisel. So I'm in sort of aware mode, but also interest and enjoyment mode when talking to someone like Katrina Lenk. So here we'll get to episode 21, part 1. There's also a fan email. Thank you, fans, writing into my Mrs. Maisel pod at gmail.com. I'll be reading one of your emails later in the program. Yeah, so in the meantime, thank you for joining. Thank you for returning. Thank you for engaging, involving. Please enjoy my conversation, part 1, with Katrina Lenk. And now, ladies and Jews, please welcome Katrina Lenk. Katrina!
Hello!
Welcome to the proceedings.
Thanks for having me.
Do you have a lot of experience in the interview podcast world or the television interview world or the YouTube interview world?
I've done some, not podcasts, but some interviews, and they always make me very nervous. So now is no exception, and now I am nervous.
Yeah, unless you have training being yourself on mic or camera instead of a character you're portraying. It doesn't make a lot of sense to most actors. I know the first time I met the great, and you're forced to call him Bob De Niro, and he found out I was a stand-up. He was just really afraid to even talk about it. I mean, it was a whole lot of, I don't understand how you do that. No, you know, I'll be honest with you. There's no script. You just stand up there and you just, I don't get it, you know.
You have transformed just now. I'm looking at you and it's like I'm seeing Robert De Niro.
It's an issue. Yeah. Yeah. And there's a little bit of a YouTube rabbit hole you can follow the rest of my shenanigans on. But people who like yourself are able to lose their own identity within a character when acting, then have a little intimidation issue with talking as themselves in an interview setting.
That's a very kind way of putting it. I'm gonna tell that to myself instead of just,
it makes sense.
What's wrong with me?
Yeah, I mean, I love to try to find the logic and everything. I'm not sure if you noticed that. And I mentioned in the invite that my better half, Jamie, who's our research producer on this here pod, we did see you in Company and we're just mesmerized. The whole show was great, but
thanks.
Yeah, I'm the opposite of everyone else who works on Maisel. That is to say, I know very little about the theater and its rich history and all the things, you know. I every time we go to the theater, I love it. I have an incredible time. Because I started out in stand-up, I never understood the concept. Why would I want other people on stage? Wait a second, what? How does this? And I talk to them? Well, that makes no sense. Time I go, I'm transfixed. That's all a big lead up as a way to qualify that I may be wrong when asking, are you the first woman to play that part? Certainly on Broadway.
In America, Rosalie Craig actually was the first woman to play it in the London production that they did.
Should we call that the West End, just so I feel like I know what I'm talking about?
Yes, that sounds good. West End.
Okay.
West End. And Patti LuPone was in that as well. And then when they brought it here, they had an all-American cast. So Rosalie Craig would be the first, and then I guess then I would be the second, but first American.
Yeah. The idea of a woman in that part was born in the UK. So what are your feelings when they come to you to do it on Broadway?
That's very funny. I guess I kind of came to them. I mean, I auditioned for it and, you know, had to go through a process of auditioning and callbacks and work sessions and stuff.
Do you bring the Tony with you to the audition?
You know, it's usually
such a power move.
It's usually getting cleaned or, you know,
there you go.
So the timing,
yeah,
timing of it.
I just picture a pit crew from Formula One who come into the house cleaning the Tony.
Yeah, it requires. That's what it requires. It's very serious business. It's a lot of marble. It's very heavy. I can't pick it up.
No.
Yeah.
I should mention to folks who are as ignorant as myself, that Tony was for the band's visit, and you stood side by side with your co-star Tony Shalhoub at Tony's with having you both won.
Yeah, that was pretty neat.
And both of your first Tony's awards, right?
I didn't know it was. I don't know if it was Tony's first, but
he should have many. You're not wrong.
He should have many. Yeah,
I just remember him saying, he's got Emmys.
It was his first
in every room of the house, but
yeah. Oh, the cleaning bills for those. Jeez.
Oh, I don't even.
I know it was his first musical.
Yes.
So he was.
And he can't really sing, can he?
Oh yes, of course he can.
All right. I guess I just know from what he's what he's said.
Don't believe a word.
I didn't see the production.
Don't believe what he says.
He really insisted that he cannot, in fact, sing. Yeah.
No, he did. He did, and he had to do the hardest thing for a singer, which was just sing a cappella without any musical accompaniment, whatsoever and just pick the note out of the air and stay in tune through a whole.
Wow.
Yeah, so he had the hardest job and he nailed it.
Yeah, but it comes with that built-in wonderful excuse. I had no accompaniment. You know,
that's true. That's true.
I would like that. So you auditioned for a company, Tony mm-hmm. Left at Home Award, and that's how you got in the whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a particularly nerve-wracking final work session where Sondheim himself showed up.
Oh, my.
And this was pre-COVID, so it was live. They were like in the room behind, they were sitting behind the table and there was a piano and, oh, hello, man. Steven Sondheim, no big deal. I'm just going to sing like all of the songs in your face right now. Okay.
What?
Oh, God. Yeah. It was
Is that a musical version of line readings? What do you mean he sang all the songs?
No, I mean, all the songs that the character sings that I was auditioning for, I had to sing for.
You had to sing for him. Got it.
Yeah.
I pictured him breaking out in song. My mistake.
Oh, gosh. If only. I would have loved it if he would have.
That
yeah.
would have been.
That would have been.
Oh, yeah. Doing it in front of him.
I
don't
no
know
pressure.
That should exist in life, in any profession.
Yeah.
In front of the inventor, you have to.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's kind of the way how Maisel is. You have to do it in front of the people that wrote it and created it and are directing it. So kind of the same, a little
Great.
Bit.
Thank you for the transitional help. I almost forgot why we were here. No, you didn't audition.
No.
I refuse to believe that.
Oh, no, not the auditioning part, but like when you're doing a scene in front of the people that wrote the scene, it's similar kind of feeling of like you want to make sure you do what they intended and you don't want to mess it up and
yeah
it'll be, you know.
And did you receive almost no direction
when
you stood in front of either Amy or Dan directing, because they our experiences pace it up
yeah, they were very much into the pacing, and which I just loved about getting to be directed by the person who wrote and created the series is like Amy knows exactly how she wants it to sound and how the rhythms should be.
It is musical,
then, yeah. And she's always right. So,
yes.
know, that was fun to just be like, okay, I'll do whatever you say. Great.
Although your character didn't have to pace it up, as I recall. Well, certainly
she
not
was like, she was like one of the slower speaking individuals.
Well, it's beautifully paced. Without the normal speed, because we as the audience watching are desperately trying to fill in the blanks of what this woman is thinking and what she's about to say. And the delay of that information is killing me. Why is she just staring Rose down before she speaks with her hanging slice of pizza? That's what I remember.
Oh, gosh, so much pizza. I ate a lot of pizza that day.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was good pizza, too, from what I remember.
Do you have a favorite person in film who you watch eating and you think, I don't know how they're doing it? Because, you know, the thing about eating on camera is you really have to pace yourself.
Yeah. You cannot take big bites. You have to take the teeniest bites in the world.
Do you remember any story of how you learned that?
I learned that by doing all the wrong things. I think in this particular episode, actually, it was.
Wow.
I was like, oh, I'll just take a bite of pizza, whatevs. And then several takes later, I'm like, oh, no, that was not a good idea. So they kindly brought a cup and I would take a bite, chew it, and then spit it out.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's how I learned about that. Like, oh, right. I can't actually eat as much pizza as I want.
I learned on Avalon, we were shooting Thanksgiving for 3 days, felt like 3 years. And it was my first real dramatic film. And but I was encouraged by Barry Levinson, the writer director, to be very loose and natural and don't ever act. And so I came to set that first morning. We were shooting 3 days of Thanksgiving and I was starving. And then I had to match that.
You had to match it.
Eating for 3 days. Because it was my first. I mean, I was so naive. We were on location and I was so naive. I went to the production office and timidly asked one day on an off day, do you know where I would get stamps? You know, the production office can have someone killed when you're on location. True. And I'm looking to buy some stamps.
Did you find stamps?
Oh, sure.
Did they have stamps?
Oh, sure. But I'm realizing as I'm saying this, I could have just gone to a post office, but it was 1989. You couldn't Google where's the post office.
No, you can't. No.
No. But also, because of my first time away on a location shoot for 3 months, I packed from home as if I were moving there for 3 months.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like mm-hmm. not a set of clothing that I could wash. No, no.
Right. No.
3 months of clothing.
No. Yeah. Trunks. Like steamer trunks.
Yeah. As if a Maisel was packing.
Right. And all the books you ever meant to read. To read. Oh my God.
Yeah. Well, you like red books.
All the books you ever meant to read.
Speaking of which, you must have read I Talk Pretty One Day.
I guess I did.
Sedaris, David Sedaris, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe it might even be Me Talk Pretty One Day.
Me, it might be, yeah.
so you're not alone. Well, damn it, tell me about your, before we go break down the episode that you're not in, tell me about your first day on the Maisel production. Was it a wardrobe fitting? Was it a table read? Was it a first day of shooting? What was the...
Let me reach back into the recesses of my memory. I guess it was like 2017. And is that 5 years ago? Oh my God. Wow.
I know. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's crazy.
Minus the 2 years that didn't happen.
Yeah. Time warp.
Yeah. I guess we must have started with a wardrobe fitting with
Donna
Zukowski, right? And it was so, I think we had two different, No. So there's a day, but it was like several hours, and she had all of these like actual vintage clothing pieces to choose from, like the turban that wears from the 50s or something. It's all from that era, and all this jewelry. It was really fun trying on all these different scarves and jewelry and all this authentic vintage clothes.
Yeah.
The detail she would apply to every single garment was also, I mean, you can see it through the whole series. Obviously, it's really incredible.
Yes. Yes, and I encourage people this time of year when they're starting to think about Christmas gifts, check out Donna's book, weirdly available on Amazon. Yeah, it's a beautiful photo coffee table book, I guess you'd call it, because it's so big. And it's all her life of creating the Maisel look.
Oh. And
it's extensive. It is beautifully laid out. And
I'm writing this down.
Great Christmas gift. Yeah.
Thanks for that.
Yeah, no. In fact, I threatened to give away a couple of signed copies to listeners. We're going to create some contests.
So
I had Don on the podcast, and we did talk about all of these things. And you mentioned the turban and the thing. So the fun for her would have been this is a character who's a period shyster, right? So she's dressing, she's costuming herself to look like, right? So all of the layers of, right?
Performing in a way.
Yeah, super, super great. And did you eventually attend a table read?
I don't think I ever did a table read. This was... Both episodes, so there's, I think, one in season one and one in season two, and each time I was doing, I was lucky enough to get to be doing a show. I was doing theater at the time. I think the first time was Indecent, and the second time was Fans Visit, if I'm remembering right. So my schedule was so tight, and the production was really great about, like, we'll just bring you in and then get you out in time for curtain. So I'm not even sure I would have been available to go to the table read, but I wish I could have, because I bet they're really fun.
Oh yeah, they've been talked about too much on this podcast, but that's how fun they are. They have been, Yeah, so I'm always curious what people's experience was. And then Amy directed the episodes.
Dan was there too, but it was mostly Amy did most of the directing. Yeah. Yeah, and we were all in that tiny little room where the fortune teller happens. And so, so Amy was sitting on this very big plush velvety chair, like that's in the scene, but when, you know, the camera's not on her, she was sitting there, and there's a full little kitchen that I would come from, and it just, even just the details in the set and things that you might not even see on camera were just so good, and juicy.
Bill Groom and his whole team making every square inch of the frame a composition for the painting.
Indeed.
And this was on set, these or practical locations the first time?
No, they're both on set. Yeah.
Both builds. Yeah. Great.
Yeah.
Phenomenal.
Yeah.
Well, anything from those experiences that come to mind along our journey here, please, if it presents itself, I'd love to hear any more. I don't want to press you any further for coughing up any juicy tidbits of inside information, but if there's anything in particular that comes to mind, I would invite you to share.
Okay.
Season 3 starts off in the most ginormous.
Oh my gosh, yes.
I mean, it starts off very small inside Joel Maisel's office bedroom. The morning after the season finale of season 2, where they wake up, of course. Had you watched the series?
Yes.
Prior?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so I had to also remind myself where we were in the story.
Yes.
And they do such a good job about with that too at the beginnings of each season. There's the way that you're reminded about what happened before is done so well and so seamlessly integrated with it, with what's happening now. It's so good. And I love that it started with the camera just tight on Midge, and you're kind of remembering with her the night before, and then it pulls out and then you see Joel, and then just that whole beautiful quiet moment, and then bam, all those tap dancing girls at the USO.
Yeah. Also the sound bridge as Midge, that great little time jump when she leaves his bedside and what leaves frame, comes back fully dressed and ready to leave.
Oh, yes.
It's so clever. But then as she walks away, the sound bridge from the following scene of so many toes tapping on that USO show stage. It looks like she's marching off with many feet of her own. But we're then swept into this. You know, this is where this military base USO show, it almost like it feels like what we all sort of celebrated working on the show, which is this mandate between the previous season and the next season. They would, we assume, be in their room of story arc breaking and season arc breaking. And then that moment of, yes, but how are we going to start the season? We have to be bigger than last year. We have to be more grand. And
they did it this one for sure.
I mean, these wonderful, extraordinary dancers just take your breath away.
Yeah.
And also the camera has that incredible move from on the dancers pretty close up to pulling all the way back to the back of the airplane hangar. And I know it's an airplane hangar because the camera pulls so far back. This place is so huge. It is housing two fighter planes along with 980 background actors in full wardrobe.
Wow.
Yeah, we apparently set a record.
That's not something you can do now, I guess, huh?
I mean,
yay COVID.
Yeah, I mean, since we started back to working shooting in COVID in 21 and 22, we carry, I think they said at least 100 background extras and test background actors and test them as much as they test the series regulars. So
that makes sense.
But in this case, 980, and I asked Donna, so wait, you had wardrobe fittings? You don't just throw green clothing at 980 people. Yeah, we had wardrobe fittings for 980 people.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
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 Wow.
Yeah. It's so beautiful, wonderful, and impressive and ridiculous. And also, what a great way to be swept into this fictional world. And
definitely. And then can we talk about,
please,
can we just talk about the camera work when first Midge and Susie appear on the Jeep?
Yes. And we're gonna.
Is it one take?
Okay.
I had to rewind it and watch it again. I was like, oh my God, how did they do this?
So yeah. So there is a oneer here. I timed it. I thought it was gonna be much longer. It comes in at about 3 minutes. It felt like 10 minutes. So much happens. That I too watched it several times. And I'm glad you mentioned it because I foolishly wrote it all down. At the 2-minute, 9-second mark of this episode, that's already spectacular with the dancing and the 900 men in 1960. I don't think there were many women in uniform. At the 2-minute, 9-second mark of the episode begins the single most insane oneer of the entire series. I'm just going to say it. And this show became famous for its oneer. From a distance away, we pick up a Jeep across the tarmac and hear Midge and Susie mid-conversation. When the Jeep turns and heads toward us, as it gets closer, our camera POV falls in place with it. So the camera was stationary. And then suddenly when this Jeep is moving at a rapid pace, we're suddenly not 50 feet from it. We're riding right along with it.
Yeah.
Maintaining perfect focus between the hero car and the camera car. That is impossible. That Jeep lands, and while our camera doesn't seem to step out of its car, it is now somehow on foot again, staying in pace with Midge and Susie as they walk from the Jeep. That is done so seamlessly, it doesn't even cross your mind while you're watching it. What just happened? We're still in the water as Midge and Susie are met by Sergeant Burns, who's upset because, you guessed it, this is the Army and you're not supposed to be late in the Army. That's just great.
Yeah.
How many times they had to rehearse all of this? Because as the camera continues to never stop moving and stays with them as they walk into the hangar, there's all sorts of things going on behind them, right?
Yes.
There's like a Western band maybe that's walking by in the background.
Oh, right.
There's all sorts of, because it's a show and there's
just
a constant movement of people. It's just so.
Yeah, Miss America is being introduced or something.
Eventually on stage. So our camera never stops moving. Myriad of perfectly dressed, staged background actors who represent everyone from other performers who are there to also entertain the troops to a photographer, more on him later. So the camera continues to stay in. It took me an hour to write this down. I'm sorry.
No, it's good. It's good.
The camera continued to stay in step with Midge, Susie, and Sergeant Burns as his instructions and Midge's confusion over having to sing White Christmas during the finale later play out. This oneer is nowhere near over. Sergeant Burns then hands Midge off to another soldier who escorts her to the foot of the stairs, and then he escorts her to a third. She comments on the grip of these soldiers. Let's not forget that our one camera shot is now also moving up these stairs, having never ventured upstairs. It just lands with her on the stage, but from now the back of the stage, through the dancers, we see Midge move across, being guided by this third soldier. She waves to the audience, and then he the camera moving all along. Let's see, doing some 10 feet away so that, in fact, we can once again take in the scope of the airplane hangar filled with GIs. She crosses over, waving, to the 980 gathered. She continues across this massive station until she is met by a fourth soldier, cracking wise. This is how rumors are started, Midge says, which is just, you know, these little gems that they just, no opportunity missed, right?
Yeah.
Oh, and let's not forget that as Midge was ushered down some more stairs on the other side of the stage onto the hangar floor, our camera somehow also got off the stage and into this angel-like gliding motion, it never signaling to us that it ventured anywhere, but once again is on eye level with her without losing the focus the entire time. Is this
David Mullins that's doing this? Is this Eric?
Definitely David Mullen, but it's Jim McConkie is our Steadicam operator, who I will have on the show and ask all these questions because this is way beyond just one Steadicam. There's all kinds of things happening. And sure enough, then Susie rejoins Mid at the other side. We're not done. Sergeant Burns comes back with further instructions. And then they're loaded into another Jeep. And as it drives out of the hangar, finally, we roll the title credit card of the show. And you're right. If you're aware of camera, you do have to watch it again right away.
Yeah.
How did this happen? Yeah. It's
like magic or something.
It is a magic trick. I do want to point out that Tom Lipinski portrayed Sergeant Burns so great.
So good.
As is the entire supporting cast, and the dancers were genius. And of course, our phenomenal choreographer, Marguerite Derricks, who simply, you cannot say enough about what she does for the show and what she does for this episode.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Had you been involved in these kind of wonders on other projects? I mean, most of the people who work on this show that I've talked to, it's unprecedented, but I never want to assume that that's the case.
No, I mean, every once in a while, there's a student film where they're trying to do a really long shot and then you learn how hard that is.
Mostly
and why it's not really ever done.
They don't have time for coverage.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Necessity.
But it seems like it would be a lot of, I mean, possibly tedious, but in the best way to rehearse it, and how pleasing it would be to have that, to get that timing right for everybody. Oh, the satisfaction of that.
Yeah. And then to hear Amy say, that's perfect. Keep it. Let's do it again.
Yeah. 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 So good.
Yeah.
So good. Have you done like long wonders like that before?
No. And since I started directing a few years ago, it's now all I ever want to do is direct, but also wonders. And you coming and so many others from the theater, this is so spectacular.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, for me, it's beyond the most challenging and the most rewarding. It was devastatingly difficult for me to wrap my head around. Wait, I'm sorry. So we're not going to shoot a master and just need to be okay, not great, until we come in for the coverage. This whole thing is coverage, but there's no coverage. What? I don't even understand. What? Yeah.
Yeah.
I
guess as like a director, that really gives you complete control of the timing and what happens, and you don't have to worry about fixing it later. It's all like,
but there's also the worry of I can't fix it later. That's the truly bold part of the wonder, because you can really create paste in post.
Yeah.
You can't in a wonder, right, which is why I've heard pace it up, Kevin, so many times because they can't fix me in post.
But
I'm not the only one who feels that way. Yeah. And it is, It is very, very exciting to do as a filmmaker and storyteller, but the most ridiculous, the first time you get to post and you look at the one and you go, why is this as slow to you as it seems to me? Because there's nothing you can do.
Nothing you can do.
Yeah.
I guess you'd speed it up first. Just speed it up. Do like a Monty Python, yeah. Not Monty Python, the Benny Hill thing with it.
Yes. Right. Right. Of course. Undercranked. But also mm-hmm. it's the timing, you know, these little beats of nuance that take place within mm-hmm. this one of the soldiers that's walking Midge across. She asks him a question and he just looks at her and doesn't respond. And Jamie, who sat next to me watching things, we've been together 15 years, and you know, it's always the insiders ruining everything. And now all mm-hmm. she sees are the problems too. She knows that when an actor is in a moment like that with like this soldier with Midge and doesn't speak, it's because they have to pay them more if they speak.
Oh,
which is often the case. I don't know if it was in this particular case, but that is very often the case. But this guy, this actor is so wonderful. The way
so
he
good.
Looks at Midge and then looks back straight ahead.
Yeah.
Not as if he's been yelled at by Amy to pace up that look, but he's been yelled at by Sergeant Burns.
Right.
To never make eye contact for more than a second.
Don't speak. And yeah. If I was that actor, I would be so nervous because, you know, it's a one-er, so you don't want to be the person that messes it up. Like, and the, oh God, please don't let me mess it up.
The one-er took place over a mile of floor
right.
before they got to you.
Right. Talk about pressure, no pressure there, right?
Yeah.
Jeez.
I don't know if I've told the story of Ken will cut this out if I have, but it's worth sharing with you and the audience. So the Cradle Will Rock, is that a movie you remember? It was a period piece about the time of the theater, Mercury Theater, I think, that Houseman and Orson Welles created. It's a period piece in the 20s. So this particular Tim Robbins directed, Bill Murray and a bunch of great actors are in it. And this one scene takes place in this two block outdoor, of course, that is dressed for the 20s of wardrobe and production design. But this particular shot takes 7 hours to set up. There are five cameras in motion, one coming down on a crane and it's a steady cam. He steps off the crane. There's so much going on. It takes 7 hours to set up this thing. And there are 200 background actors along with her. And he's shooting it in a way so that our main actors who are walking through this cacophony are almost in a Robert Altman way, passing off who speaks in an audio transitional way that's happening. So after 7 hours of setting this up, Tim Robbins sitting behind the five monitors at Video Village, the first AD has a giant megaphone with which he yells, "And action!" And all of these pieces start moving and all of these cameras start capturing this shot that took 7 hours to set up. And about 38 seconds into this 3-minute shot, a background actor bumps into someone and says, "Oh shit, sorry, cut." And Tim Robbins at Video Village, the headphones come flying off his head as he races into the crowd and it screams, let's just say, an 11-minute diatribe of how no one yells cut on his set. And do you know what you just did? He loses his shit, as we've all in life have done. But he really, really loses it for a long 11 minutes. It felt like an hour, as it's told. But just calling out everything that could possibly go wrong and how you're the one that stops all of these people from working. And he just loses it. It takes another hour, 45 minutes or so, to reset this whole thing. They're finally ready to shoot again. Robin's behind the five monitors, 200 extras, every background actors, everybody's in place, ready to go. First AD back with the megaphone, and action. 6 seconds into the shot, Bill Murray goes, "And cut!" As the only actor, maybe in history, who could have done it. He takes the shot, and he scores as Tim Robbins just starts crying with laughter, realizing the shit sandwich that's just been served up to him.
Oh.
And he eats every morsel and laughs. Because, again, Bill Murray was the only one who could have said,
yeah,
you might have overreacted. The ultimate story I've ever heard on, we don't want to be the one to blow the shot.
Oh, God. Yeah. So good.
Yeah. And I don't, it doesn't pertain whatsoever in any way, shape, or form other than just to really, really zero in on the best of the worst of what can happen.
Yeah.
When you attempt these absurd shots and how every single person feels this. You know, just this Jew davening inside their heads. Please don't be the one. Please don't be the one. Please don't be the one. You can't be the one. It's almost like within a one, no one's actually in the moment. There's no.
Yeah.
But these performances, and you mentioned at the top of it, Midge and Susie in the Jeep, their banter.
Oh, they're sparkling, like sparking.
Lightning fast, and the timing and the performances are deeply nuanced. And it's not two frightened actors trying to not fuck up.
No,
the shot.
No, not at all. Yeah, yeah. And I just, that's one of the things I love about the show is that I just look at it like a baby. Like, wow, I'm just amazed. And I completely forget that I'm an actor, that I've ever done anything or that how anything works. And I'm able to just be completely swept away by the story and what they're doing.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, it's such a. So then we're in this sort of dressing room area that is set up somewhere.
Yes.
Where we see again Marianne Mobley, who in 1959, according to her sash, she's Miss America. She's hilarious, wonderfully
hilarious.
Portrayed by Amanda Dela Cruz. And Midge needs to change. Susie needs to make it clear there should be no dick jokes, and we are thankfully treated to a couple, several of which are just hilarious.
So good. Richard. The Richard one was good.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so not like the show. It's almost like a writer's gift to be able to comment on, here's something we would never do. And oh, by the way, here's how you should do it.
Yeah.
If you're gonna.
And then it's a lady making these jokes too, is also.
It's a weird clinic on, okay, you know what, people? If you're going to be potty mouthed, try it this way. Be this damn creative.
Yeah.
And you're right.
And she's like a machine gun with them. They just bam, 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 one after another coming out of that dressing.
And the joy of just trying. Screen. Yeah. The joy of just trying to make Susie laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Which reminded me earlier, just a little few beats before this, when the fourth time Midge tries to make one of the soldiers laugh and Susie says, "Let it go." Midge makes a flippant comment to the guys helping her into the Jeep. And Susie says, "Let it go." And Midge says, "Never." That challenge of, I mean, I unfortunately can relate to that. There's no off switch thing. And when you're around nothing but stiffs, there is this uncontrollable urge to make them laugh. And you just can't stop. It's very, very sad. then next in the barracks on a phone call, Susie takes this call and there are three fellas gathered around a table back at the stage deli.
Andy Polk is one of them. My old pal, Andy Polk.
Oh yeah. Playing Fred, the sort of lead guy. You've worked with Andy Polk, have you?
Yeah. He was on the band's visit. Tony and me. Yeah.
Wow.
He's great.
And he's so great in this and in several mm-hmm. episodes and in everything mm-hmm. I see him in. He's just great.
Yeah.
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 And it's quickly explained that they've been taxed with helping Susie negotiate Midge's contract. She doesn't, Susie, it's a great way to let us know or view Susie learning the job as she's doing it. She doesn't know what to ask for. They're trying to look up old contracts of what people were paid. It's very, very funny. And you just assume authentic. So-and-so made $10 a night when they opened
yeah.
up. Yeah. Yeah. And but then they point out my favorite part. Make sure she needs to make a weird ask.
Weird asks.
Have you ever had a weird ask? Have you ever?
No, witnessed? But I have been told. Yeah. I have been told that it's how you know that they've read the contract. It's not so much that you need these things, but it's a sign that the contract has been read and taken seriously.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, yeah. I think it was Van Halen that was on tour who insisted on the brown M&Ms being taken out of the bowl. And they did it for that sole reason.
Yeah.
And I don't think most people know that. Write to us at the podcast if you know that it isn't Van Halen, so I can correct myself in the wraparound. But there was a band, and I did hear one of them explain. Yeah, we weren't quote unquote those people. It was the only way we'd ever know if they read the contract.
Like a canary in a coal mine, sort of.
Yeah. So you personally haven't had a weird ask. Have you ever witnessed a weird ask from someone you were working with? I know it's funny. Sometimes I'll arrive at some private gig backstage for stand-up, and they'll say, is this fruit plate okay? Is this, we were told you have to. I was like, yeah, okay, ease up on the, it's going to be all right. It's going to be all right. They asked me, my reps, is there anything you want in the dressing room? And I would say no. Yeah, but anything? Water?
Water?
Bottled water? Okay,
yeah.
Anything else? And they just press you and they force you. So then it ends up me letting this person, trying to talk them down from the clock tower with the M16, saying, it's okay, it's going to be okay.
I didn't really want this anyway.
I'm not going to eat it.
Would
you like some of the fruit that sits before us? Yeah.
No, I haven't witnessed anything, not yet, but when I do, I will let you know.
Okay, good.
Any weird asks. Yeah,
please.
I'll make a note.
Yeah. And anyone listening, please write in all the strange asks you've ever heard of. Because you do sort of become obsessed when you hear about, you're reminded, oh, right, the weird ask thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they even list a few when they're explaining to Susie on the phone, so-and-so asked for this.
Yeah.
And I haven't asked Amy, but my assumption is they didn't make those up.
Oh.
But I'm going to find out. Yeah.
If they did make them up, I bet they were extremely researched references, I would imagine.
And maybe applied to famous names.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll find out. Then we're back at the hangar show. Midge and Susie, it's showtime. And Midge is being introduced. Before she takes the stage, we get a very classic tits up moment between Midge and Susie. This, of course, becomes the runner, one of the runners that continues to bond their relationship. But Midge bounds up the stage. She's absolutely fearless. And I will tell you, there is an excitement in a natural born performer. I direct, the first thing movie I directed was a documentary about funny people. It's called Misery Loves Comedy. And it's really, the premise is, do you have to be miserable to be funny? So I talked to about 60 annoyingly famous funny people. It's a talking heads documentary. It's not really impressive in terms of filmmaking, but you know, there's a wide range of how miserable you have to be. But the level of I'm most comfortable when I'm on stage versus in real life is pretty high. And taking the stage is a want and a need. And so it tends to come with more excitement than nerves. In fact, I was just speaking with someone at my weekly poker game, and they were asking me about appearing on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson and how nervous you must have been backstage before you go out. And I would say it was like Christmas morning every time. I was so excited. A Christmas morning for a child. I mean, it was just pure excitement. There wasn't any thoughts of, oh man, I hope I don't screw this up. I don't know why.
Oh, how great.
It was just the instant or being present in the moment to celebrate what was happening. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of crazy. Yes, I know it's a weird, awkward transition and where to end episode one decision. My apologies, but you know, you'll hopefully understand as you listen to part two, which again, hopefully you will, why I chose that moment. Anyways, big, big thanks to Katrina Lenk. She is an exceptional talent, and we will continue to break down the episode. There'll be a little less of my interrupting with my glorious stories in part two, and a little more of Katrina. Thank you all very much for dialing us in, and continue to write to us at mymrsmajorpod@gmail.com. Again, major, major, major thanks to Katrina Lenk, the Tony Award-winning Katrina Lenk. So write to us. Tell us your thoughts and comments and questions about part one of episode 21. I would love to see how many of you agree with me that this was a good decision to break this into two parts. In terms of where I chose to break it up, as it turns out, and you may have guessed, there was no great option. This was an option. So apologies and gratitude for your indulgence. Hey, shall we open up the mailbag? I believe I threatened the reading of a fan mail, and damn it, I meant it. So yeah, let's open up the mailbag. We opened the mailbag to a fan mail from Travis from Roanoke, Virginia. Let's see. Travis writes, "Thank you for doing these podcasts. I really enjoy them. With the above referenced podcast, I would like to know the meaning behind the saying crisscross between Chester and Susie. Is it because they are doing the same thing at the Catskills, or is it because their paths keep crossing? To me, it seems to have a deeper meaning. Thank you. Signed, Travis." Well, Travis, look at you. Look at you and Dee Dee. Yeah, all right. Listen, Connor Ratliff was a phenomenal guest on this here podcast. I'm going to bring him back. I love talking to him. I reached out to him to get an answer to your question, Travis. So here now is the man in question, Connor Ratliff.
Thank you for your question. I always assumed that Chester was saying crisscross as a reference to the Hitchcock movie Strangers on a Train, which is a film from 1951, a thriller based on the Patricia Highsmith novel about two strangers, who one of whom is a psychopath, who approaches the other man and proposes an idea for a murder swap, whereby each of them would kill someone on behalf of the other person, so that you'd have two killings. They'd have alibis for the murders that they wanted to have happen, but then no motive for the murders that they would actually be committing. The phrase crisscross is used in that movie with a similar sort of tone. And I always thought, even though obviously Chester is not proposing such a scheme with Susie, but he's sort of using that as a way of insinuating that they are kindred spirits, that they each are there in the Catskills, running the same scam, pretending that they're working there, when in fact they are not supposed to be there. And again, I never asked Dan or Amy if it was specifically referencing that movie. But also, there were other scenes with Chester. There was a scene specifically where Chester was coming out of a shower and there was a bird in the scene. And I thought, I wonder, are they always layering Hitchcock references around Chester? Because Chester is in some ways very much like the kind of character who lurks around in various Hitchcock films. So that's my two cents on it. I think it is sort of... He's insinuating himself into Susie's life with a kind of familiarity, as if they're birds of a feather in a way. And I think the crisscross was his way of like linking them, making them complicit in one another's schemes at the Catskills. I could be wrong, but that's how I always interpreted it.
Okay, closing credits time. My Mrs. Maisel pod was created by me, your host, Kevin Pollack, research writer, producer, Jamie Fox, and our engineer, recording, post-production producer genius is Ken Plume. My Mrs. Maisel pod is brought to you by the fine folks at QCO. QCO. Sounds like something, doesn't it? Oh, lastly, you should know, told by legal to make this crystal clear, that my Mrs. Maisel pod was not sanctioned in any way, shape, or form by Amazon Prime, nor the show's creators Amy Sherman Palladino and Dan Palladino, although I feel the need to mention I did get their blessing. Okay, good. That should save me some legal fees.
Everyone needs a break from the real world. That's why we played games as kids, and that's why we should play games as adults. I'm Troy LaValle.
And I'm Joe O'Brien. And back in 2015, we started a podcast called The Glass Cannon Podcast, a show made up of comedians and actors playing a fantasy role-playing game.
And now is the perfect time to start listening because we just started a brand new story.
It's basically Lord of the Rings meets Game of Thrones meets X-Files.
Search for The Glass Cannon Podcast on your podcast app of choice. Hey, life is hard, so come play pretend with us.